Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jane Bernstein. Jane Bernstein is a professor of English and creative writing at Carnegie Mellon University. She's the author of Loving Rachel, A Family's Journey from Grief, Bereft, A Sister's Story, and other books. She'll be reading tonight from her memoir, Rachel in the World, published by University of Illinois Press. Hi, Jane. Welcome to Prosody.
I'm happy to be here.
How about you start us out tonight reading a little bit from Rachel in the World?
Okay. I'm going to read a section from a chapter about Rachel being 17 years old to give a sense of what she was like as an adolescent. When Rachel was 17, Charlotte shot a short documentary about her sister for a sophomore project at film school. She claimed that Rachel was her second choice as a subject and that her intention had originally been to make a film about lobstering in Maine, but the logistics made it impossible. Shooting the documentary gave her a chance to see Rachel from a different vantage point. Charlotte wasn't just a sister, responding to a complex, difficult sibling. She was a filmmaker, scrutinizing Rachel in an intense, if distanced, way. Rachel loved being the star and basked in the attention she got. She also developed a fierce crush on a handsome crew member named Mark. Whenever Charlotte tried to walk beside him, Rachel would elbow her away and wrap her arm around Mark's neck. It didn't surprise me. She wanted to be in my relationship, too, to butt between us and follow us everywhere. When I try to describe Rachel from this period, Charlotte's words seem most apt. Like us, she said of her sister, talkative, outgoing, eager for new experiences, the type of person who liked being in the center of things. If she was normal, she'd be a real badass. This was funny and absolutely true. Wasn't it the case that there were three generations of stubborn, opinionated, badass women who didn't play by all the rules? The problem is that Rachel didn't want to play by any of the rules. Like us, yes, a real badass, yes, a typical teenager in the way she liked to listen to her Walkman while playing a computer game with a TV blaring in the background, typical in the way she cared about what she wore and had her own distinct sense of cool. Our arguments weren't about drugs or boys sneaking out of the house or throwing parties when I was out of town. We quarreled about hygiene because she would often shower without soap or let the water run for a moment, then cheerfully call out, "All done." We quarreled because she eschewed toilet paper and would not tell me when she had her period, despite the lessons and monthly reminders that it was part of being a woman. I could ease her into wearing a sanitary napkin, though she was likely on such a morning, to climb onto the school van where her friends were sitting, Josh, Uri, and Max, and announce, "I'm wearing a pad." We quarreled because she threw her body against my bedroom door when the sun came up, demanded her breakfast, and kept demanding, no matter that she was not allowed to wake me until her alarm went off. She wanted cereal in the blue bowl, and she wanted it right now. Every day began with Rachel arguing, continued through breakfast and beyond, with her opposing even my most trivial requests, like this. "Rachel, put your bowl in the dishwasher. Yakety yak. I mean it. Yak, yak, yak. If you don't do it at the count of three, no computer." A pause, a decision, her prideful answer, "Yeah, whatever." When we were apart, I often thought it was thrilling, the way my once passive baby, who had to be woken for feedings and coaxed to smile, had blossomed. Gone was the little girl, beautiful and curly-haired, whom nothing could delight, not a stuffed bear, a noisy toy, a glittering barrette. At 17, Rachel was bristling with desires and demands. They were tangible things she wanted, privilege she demanded, and rules that offended her deeply. Mostly, though, she wore me out.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jane Bernstein. Jane, I think with a book like this and with your first book about Rachel, there might be a tendency to want to jump into the content and the material right away, but I want to talk about the writing a little bit first. One of the things I was thinking is that and in that scene, we see it where Rachel can be a source of pressure. And one of the ways she's a source of pressure is in language, that she's constantly talking, demanding someone to answer her, pay attention. And I was thinking that you create this, you know, wonderful dichotomy in the fact that you're the person who's always with that talking person, but other people think it's charming and funny. And so I was wondering, just in terms of the way you were your relationship as a writer to language. One language is a writer's blood. And then also in the way that you were crafting this, like, has Rachel in trying to render her on the page made you think about language any differently, or did you struggle with anything in terms of how you were representing, trying to represent the pressure of her constant kind of chatter?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to begin with, when I found out that she had intellectual disabilities, not knowing what it meant, and I was kind of holding on to what I wanted most, I wanted a child who had language. Watch out what you ask for. You know, in the end, that's what I thought. So it's tremendously important to me because I am really verbal. It is my prime mode. And she is hyperverbal. And I think the piece of her that's attractive to outsiders who aren't overwhelmed by her is that she has this tremendous amount of language. And as a parent and a writer, in fact, I did become really sensitive to it, and I was constantly listening and scrutinizing and recording her and writing things down and trying to figure out of all this stuff that she said, what was true, that is, what represented her desires or herself, and what was simply mimicking. And that really was all the years. I mean, once she started to have language, that was one of the major things I ended up doing with her. It did give me a lot of sensitivity to language.
Sure. And as you were transferring it to the page, it sounds like it was mainly a process of kind of not just whittling down, but trying to get at the heart of, you know, in a certain way, the same way you do in fiction when you're working with a character and trying to figure out how they talk. She had a lot to say, but you really were still trying to figure out, you know, how is it I render her as someone who speaks?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why, in a certain way, there are a couple of chapters in the book where I have transcribed tapes of things that she said to me. And partly I did it because I really want people to have a sense of her. And I have all kinds of reasons for that. But I wanted people to know who she was as an individual. And also partly from my own information, again, as a parent, in trying to figure out who she was, looking at it on the page the way I would, it's true, the character, distancing myself, looking at what was there, and then figuring out what it meant, all this stuff. And, you know, again, sometimes going through things, I could feel what, oh, yeah, this is actually feels like it's from her, and this she heard from this person, and that she heard from somebody else, and
yeah,
you know, it comes together in some mysterious way.
Yeah, in a way, she was almost a tape recorder herself.
Yeah.
That she'd repeat back these sound bites that
yeah.
she'd pick up.
And then sometimes she would be extraordinarily clear. For whatever reason, in her distress with a particular friend, those were the moments that she seemed very clear. On the phone with this particular young woman, when they quarreled, she would say things like, why are you mean to me, and you're hurting my feelings? And I would think, wow, I mean, this is actual communication that I'm hearing, much different from talking about somebody else's dry cleaning or wanting to go to Chi-Chi's because somebody in her class went there, and, you know, that kind of bird-like repetition.
Right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jane Bernstein. Jane, will you read some more from Rachel in the World?
Sure. I'm going to choose an earlier section. It's not actually that much earlier. And this is from a chapter called Rachel Flies Alone. And the setup is simply that Rachel's father and I divorced, and he was in Florida and really eager for her to visit, and we decided that we would let her fly by herself. She was able to fly as a minor, ostensibly, and so that we were kind of trying to figure something out where we would know for certain that people from the airline would watch her on either end. But arranging this trip really gave me pause and raised a lot of questions, not only about what I felt were Rachel deserved, but what I felt the responsibility of strangers were to my daughter, who was hyperverbal and very difficult. So those are some of the questions that that were raised by this upcoming trip. And so I'm going to read a little scene that is essentially my imagining Rachel on this plane without me. That night in my kitchen, I imagined my daughter on a plane alone, ordering a drink. Who would open her seat back tray? Who would help her put the drink in the indented circle, and the silverware wrapped in plastic? As for the peanuts, I couldn't even open that little bag without chewing at the edge. Who would open it for Rachel? I imagined a woman passenger seated beside her. What would she see when she looked at my daughter? A girl with curly hair, nicely cut, gorgeous porcelain skin, a brush of fair freckles. Rachel's eyes wandered, though not as much as they had years before when the nystagmus was pronounced. Her gaze was rather blank. If experience is what marks our faces with crow's feet and frown lines, maybe Rachel's face was unmarked, expressionless, because experience never fully penetrated. I could make her laugh by calling her thunder buns or buffalo breath, and the expression on her face would be full of delight. Otherwise, though, it was impossible to read her without doing something radical, like tickling her. When she was small, her oddities were cute. Now she was 5 feet tall. A child? A teenager? I imagined her seatmate wondering. Her body was bulky and square, underdeveloped sexually, though not for long. I suspected that people sensed something different about her, the blank face, rather than thinking of her right away as retarded. If I was correct, it was because of her uncanny talent as a mimic, her ability to catch gesture, inflection, cadence, emphasis. I heard myself in her voice. When she answered the phone, she used my hey instead of hi, and copied the way I said, so how you doing? When she talked to her father, she cleared her throat the way he did and said, how's Aunt Bee? How's Pop-Pop? Let me switch ears. Then there was the adolescent stuff, yeah, whatever, when I asked her to do something, and duh, for unmitigated scorn. I imagined Rachel on the plane saying, excuse me, I don't mean to bother you, but may I ask you a question, please? Her graciousness was so charming, even the least friendly passenger would turn, and then it would be all over. The minute my daughter had someone close, she would begin to talk and never stop, never. What initially passed as conversation turned into a numbing, endless series of questions and statements. On first hearing, these seemed grounded, real. My sister Charlotte, she finally got into college, and I saw Aladdin, she hadn't. My sister lives in L.A., not anymore. My friend, she was going to come over, but she got confused, and it was such a riot. Last week, my mother picked me up, and actually she was going to talk to her friend, but in an hour, and we laughed so hard. You want to hear a joke? Knock, knock. And on and on. At home, when friends and family were around, I tried to nip the meaningless loops that were so engaging at first, so seemingly coherent. Relying on old standbys that I had learned when she was in preschool, I would cue her, giving her a specific topic, and redirect her by reminding her to stick to that topic. Sometimes I simply said no more stories and made her stop rattling off a stream of questions that didn't need answers. It was annoying. Besides, I hated to see her continually reinforced for behavior that was socially unacceptable and that ultimately would alienate people, making her more marginalized than she already was.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jane Bernstein, reading from her memoir, Rachel in the World. Because it's a memoir, it's written in first person. That makes sense. But there's something about the first person, the I pronoun, that I found really intriguing, because this voice is really honest, and it cuts at times into back into the person who's speaking. You kind of evaluate yourself as a mother. You evaluate the world as how it treats people who are different. There is a real kind of vulnerability in the voice and a strength as well. But when it goes to those moments, it's particularly because you're writing about a mother-child relationship, that I have to think at some point in the writing, you had to think, oh, you know, the reader's going to struggle with this a little bit. But it stayed true. So one question I have is, did that happen just as the writing was coming out, or was that something in kind of your editing process that you had to go back and kind of say, no romance, no sentimentality, we're going to push this? I'm just, because in a way, even though, again, it's a memoir, I'm not thinking this is a voice that if you're sitting down over dinner with someone and you're talking about, that that's the same voice you would use.
No, it certainly wasn't the same voice. At the same time, I have to say I'm a little surprised that most of the response I've gotten about the book has been exactly what you've said, that people have found it kind of gritty and very honest. My own feeling as a writer is that I was really trying to tell a story that I felt hadn't been told, and that I didn't want to have any vanity, and I didn't want to protect myself. I really felt and still feel that this is actually more Rachel's story than my own, and so I put myself in it only, well, certainly I'm filtering everything, you know, it's through my sensibility. But it was the only way that I could tell what it was like to actually have my specific daughter, my particular daughter, who was and is willful and full of desires, but also has mental retardation and is not somebody who's particularly reasonable. I felt like that was the only way to do it.
No, I think it's, I guess one of the things is because it's in first person and just how we read, we're going to bond with that first person perspective. We're in those eyes, in that body, experiencing those experiences. And so that, I think this is a voice that isn't out there and should be. The challenges of parenting. I think they're, even with children who don't have mental disabilities, I think there at times there's a lot of kind of romanticization of it that, oh, it's all so wonderful and all the bad things were worth it for the good things. And, you know, all of those things may be true, but the challenges are kind of slid over. And so for me, it was also just being in your consciousness and having you not take that romantic tact. And being a reader and having to really, it made me think, how do I react to these kind of, you know, I remember a line where it's a lot of times people who are different, we look away from. And this book doesn't look away. Now, it can't because of the relationship, but it also makes people as readers, you can't look away either. And so I do think it's Rachel's story, most definitely. But I think there's this really interesting dynamic that goes on because the voice won't let us look away, won't let us make it romantic or sentimental.
Well, I hope it doesn't. I don't lose too many readers. I know that it's difficult enough to ask somebody to read a book about somebody with mental retardation. It's not a particularly sexy topic. And so I hope it's not so harsh in that sense that I, you know, I lose people.
No, I didn't feel it was harsh because there's also through all of that, again, I think just challenges we all have with each other, period, you know, just in relationships, there is this drive to make sure she finds her space in the world. That's, you know, that to me is more powerful than trying to legitimize who she is. You're in your relationship, you're really trying to make sure that she is her own person the way she wants to be.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I really care a lot. One of my reasons for ultimately writing the book, which, as you know from reading it, I had a lot of misgivings for a long time and didn't write it for a long period of time, was that I feel that public perception of people with developmental disabilities tends to skew. Either it's people see somebody or hear about somebody with mental retardation and they respond in what I think of as the sort of bunny way. Oh, she's so sweet. Oh, she must be adorable. She must be really loving, or not wanting to know anything about it. So I think I really, again, in my wanting to put Rachel on the page, part of that was saying, look, here's my daughter. I want you to know her. She's really difficult. She happens to be really interesting also, I think.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And funny and weird and unacceptable and all these qualities. Look at who she is. She's different. But I think that look is hard. It's hard sometimes also because she doesn't play by the rules, because she is without empathy and not altruistic, and she's missing a lot of kind of values that make her likable on some level. I mean, she's interesting more than she is warm.
Yeah, well, and it's, you can see how she's engaged in the world, but in a way, because of her hyper language, people are drawn into her, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, wait, in a way that typically they would just back off.
That's exactly right. It's like, ooh, 1 minute is fine, 6 hours, not so fine.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jane Bernstein, reading from her memoir, Rachel in the World. Jane, would you read a little more?
Sure. I'll read another, speaking about issues that make people uncomfortable, I think, but I wanted very much to write about. And I'm going to read a little section here that takes place on a kibbutz-like community where Rachel lived for about 6 months in Israel. And when she was there, I had heard that there was a young man who liked her, and I went to visit her, and I couldn't find her one day. And this is a tiny little scene of finally having one of the staff people take a key and knock on a door and open the door. A moment later, Rachel appeared, attired in her grubby blue sweatshirt and sweatpants. A young man followed, Dove, I assumed. The look on my daughter's face was serene and sleepy. We were napping, she said. Her hair sprang out in all directions. Dove put his arm across her shoulders. I'm her boyfriend, he said. He was a nice-looking young man, though very upset, and he asked a series of rapid-fire questions. Was it true she was leaving in June? Was that really the case? Was I buying a house in New Jersey? It was what she'd said, but he wasn't sure. Sometimes she confused him. Could he have her address? He needed her address. She was his girlfriend. He needed to be able to write to her after she left. Dove went back into his apartment to get a pencil and pad. He gave them to me and then put his arm around Rachel again. I was surprised to see that she did not shrug it off. Not a cloud was in the sky. Dove was agitated and intense, and Rachel was mellow. Her face was slightly swollen, as if from sleep. If her sister, as a teenager, had emerged from a room with messy hair and a boy and explained, "We were napping," I would have laughed in disbelief. Looking at Rachel, I again felt certain that she had just woken. I asked Dove a few questions, mostly to hold on to this moment. He told me he was from Jerusalem. His father was a scientist at Hebrew University. Was it true I was a writer? He wanted to know because he too was a writer. He wrote poems. In fact, he invented his own language. I saw that Etty's bed had been stripped, I said to Rachel. Has she moved out? Was that because you kept waking her? Dove interceded. Why does she keep doing that? How would they ever be roommates if she kept waking people up? What was he going to do? She was his girlfriend. How would they live together? He wanted to know what else Rachel liked to do because he was worried. She was his girlfriend, but they didn't have a lot to talk about. We don't have a lot in common, he said, frantic and upset. What is she like? How will we live together? The sun blazed overhead. Rachel blinked lazily. Dove held her close. So much went through my mind. I wanted her to have a boyfriend, if that was what she desired. In an old-fashioned way, especially now with her father gone, I wanted someone to take care of her. Unlike her sister, Rachel could not look out for herself. This boy, this man, seemed so much higher functioning that it was hard to imagine how he and Rachel related or what they did when they were together. When I thought that it couldn't be sex, that Rachel, with her septo-optic dysplasia and her history of pituitary problems, had always seemed devoid of sexuality, another thought rose up. I was denying what was before my eyes. I looked at her sweet, freckled face. She was fine. Whatever went on, she was not unhappy. I want you to be nice to my daughter, I said to Dove. Do you understand? You're not to hurt her, ever.
When I read that section, do you know the story Eternal Love by Karen Bender?
I don't think I know the story. I know her work.
She has a piece. It was in Best American, I don't know, probably back in, like, it's a while ago, maybe 10 years ago. And it's about a mother who's taking her mentally retarded daughter to Vegas to get married to another young man. And she keeps saying, use soap, just use lots and lots of soap. But, you know, I remember with that story and then reading this section as well, that I think, you know, there's things in the book that will be surprising for people, but in a way like, oh, I should have known that. And that, you know, everyone is a sexual being on some level. And so then as a parent, you have to kind of figure out, negotiate what's your role in it. particularly with a daughter who can't necessarily make choices for herself.
She can't make choices, and she's very physically vulnerable. One of the issues that is woven through the book is my concern that she's not able to reliably tell me if somebody's hurt. And yet at the same time, she wants to be in the center of things. She wants to be liked. She likes having a boyfriend. She wants love, like all of us. It turns out her way of wanting love is a little bit different from mine. But how could I deny that to her? Why would I want to? So I found myself in trying to carve out what I wanted most from her is I wanted her to have a job, and I wanted her to have friends, and I wanted her to have people love her.
Right. And so one of the questions I was thinking of in reading the book, because there's also a whole line of conversation that goes on about the role of the public as well, social services, what happens. You know, I think that's something that everybody probably does think of is as you get older, what'll happen to her. And so I'm wondering if through all of this, if you've thought differently about caregiving as it would relate to you.
What an interesting question. I don't think I have. I mean, that speaking about making yourself feel vulnerable. But I've thought a lot about caregivers. I've thought a lot about this world, and I'm really speaking of the caregivers who are best, of people who are just able to nurture and somehow have the ability to nurture and not need so much in return. And that it's something, I don't know what it is, it's an attribute that's quite amazing. I mean, that's as far as I've gotten in that way. And I've seen it. I have an elderly mother, and so I've certainly seen with her a world of people who are very kind to very elderly people, many of whom are demented or demanding or, you know,
sure,
similar issues.
Well, I think if nothing else, I think sometimes, especially when we think about it in terms of aging, it's more one-directional. You know, the older person kind of needs the resources from another person. My sense is hopefully you live a long, happy, healthy life. But, you know, you'll have another perspective because you've been on the other side of it.
Right.
The person who is getting the resources tapped.
That's right. That's right. But there have been people in Rachel's life who have absolutely loved her and come back to see her, let's say, after 6 months, and she's not even slightly interested in them. And somehow they understand and they're okay with that. It's as if they can give and get what they need, and it's not a reciprocal relationship. That is what a lot more of us, and I'm one of those people, really need. I mean, I found the lack of a reciprocal relationship with Rachel to be really difficult. I wanted as a parent to be loved.
Sure. Well, Jane, thanks for coming to Prosody tonight.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh's City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Zig Edwards and Amy Sutton. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.